This morning we talked about where we've been in the Advent message. This afternoon, where we're headed. An analysis of political and economic events. We're going to take a look at current events through two lenses. Basically what's happening in our world now, and then companion to that through the lens of prophecy. We're going to see what we can figure out as to where the dots materialize, what's happening out there in the mists of the future. A lot of people are wondering about this stuff today. We have an advantage. It's called the book of Revelation. So we begin this afternoon with a question, way down deep, in that personal and private part of your mind and psyche that processes the daily news, that processes the events you see, and tries to figure out what's happening next. Do you feel some deep, perhaps indefinable sense that we could be headed for real trouble? Is that beginning to come through? That perhaps our country and our world are drifting sideways towards some danger we can't yet clearly identify, but we can begin to sense is out there. Now, if you have felt that, you have begun to recognize what any mariner, any person who's ever served in the Navy would instantly recognize. It's a phenomenon called SET. S-E-T. And let me illustrate that for you on the whiteboard. I've driven warships all over much of this world, from the North Atlantic through the Caribbean. Before Gitmo was a term most people even knew about, I spent a summer there. Through the canal twice, out into the Pacific, all the way to the Singapore Strait. So I've driven warships over much of this world. And before the military would ever let us get anywhere near the bridge of a ship with authority to issue engine or compass or, helm orders, we were required to get a pretty good education as to some of the dirty tricks the ocean can play on you. And one of them is this: SET. What we have here is a vessel that intends to dock over here by that pier. Pretty simple procedure. How do you get from where you are, which is out here several miles offshore, to alongside that pier safely, hopefully with a landing soft enough you don't have to write it up and explain it to anybody? Well, theoretically, it's pretty simple. You call the quartermaster. Quartermaster, get me a bearing on the end of the pier. Aye, sir, bearing on the pier. He goes out to the bridge wing, swings an alidade around, puts a vertical line through the end of the pier, reads off the prism the compass heading, says 093, sir. Say, very well, helmsman steer 093. Although in this instance, it probably would be more like 083. Now, theoretically, that's all you got to do. You've got a compass bearing from where you are to where you're going. Steer that compass heading, and you're going to get gently alongside the pier. Except there's an ebb tide running out through this estuary, and it's coming like this, pushing your ship sideways so that for every yard you go forward, you're pushed a few inches sideways. And the ship begins to do this. Okay? Now, in the midst of whatever else you're doing on watch, you look out there and suddenly you realize the bow of the ship's no longer on the end of the pier. You're headed for someplace inshore here. So what would you be tempted to do? Helmsman, keep the bow of the ship, keep the staff, the flagstaff up there right on the end of the pier. That ought to get you there safely, right? Wrong. You issue that order, you've just issued one that will guarantee your captain a somewhat abbreviated career. Because a collision at sea, either with another vessel or with the bottom, is a career-ending move. I'm not kidding. I was on a vessel one time where the executive officer, full three-stripe commander, miscalculated the tide coming in. We were supposed to tie up down a few yards ahead of a minesweeper. Minesweepers are made of wood because they don't want to be made of metal because they would otherwise set off magnetic mines. So this minesweeper made of wood and somewhat fragile is sitting there. The XO neglected to correctly compute for the tide, and as we came in at an angle that normally worked perfectly, this time it didn't work, and we used that minesweeper as a fender. And as we scraped down the side of that little vessel, you could hear crunch, 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 crunch. The CO of the minesweeper was on the dock headed for our mooring before we even got the number one line ashore, and his face was red enough to set his hair on fire. Our captain, who was a full four striper, in line for admiral, never got a flag. He never made admiral. His next orders were to Alaska. This thing can happen to you. So you're getting set sideways, imperceptibly sideways, when you mean to go from here to there. And if you just tell the helmsman, keep the bow of the ship on the pier, what's going to happen? You're going to be going like this. Everything's going to look okay because the pier is still out in front. And out here is a part of the ocean that's going to come up to meet you. Now, at some point along this drift, the people on board the ship are going to begin to wonder, what's going on? This doesn't look right. I can't quite define it. The ship still seems to be pointed where we're supposed to be going. My fellow Americans, the government is taking care of you. We have the pier fully in sight. Believe me, we have the welfare of the working American in our minds at all times. Okay? At some point, the passengers recognize something's wrong. They may not be able to define it, but something's going wrong with this landing. I propose to you, this is where we are today globally. We're being set by forces we have not recognized, some of which we tragically have set in motion. And the results will challenge the future of a country we love and of a world we'd just as soon not see go to pieces. Set. All right, let's now define how that applies to us. With this in mind, let's think about what, as a country, we've just done. We now have, in a sense, nationalized a huge chunk of the auto industry and the banking industry. And what I find interesting is that recently I have heard the proposal that the preferred stock in banks owned by the government is going to be converted to common stock, which means what? It's now voting stock. Now the government is in an active voting situation with respect to corporate management. We now have moved huge chunks of what once was a totally private sector into a direction which probably will lead to governmental control with the change we have made with the healthcare system. That in turn is going to introduce us to some other changes that are very, very necessary from a governmental political perspective. We're going to have to be able to monitor millions of people now. Who you are, where you fit in to the healthcare structure, what you're entitled to, what you're not entitled to. This means government is going to have to know your age, your health history, your address, your verifiable ID. There's a lot of stuff government now very legitimately will need to know, because very soon government will be providing services that heretofore had been something we had relegated to the private sector. Now there's talk of empowering an appointed federal official to decide if a business is too big to fail and needs to be taken over under governmental supervision. Now, what worries me a little bit about that, and I don't mean to sound unduly alarmist. I'm a loyal American. I wish our government well. I hope everything they do succeeds, because I personally live well. And if it doesn't work as well as they're planning, my lifestyle is going to change appreciably. But what concerns me about putting more and more of the private sector under governmental review is this. The government has had control of the Postal Service for 235 years, and the Postal Service is broke. They've had Social Security for 75 years, and it's broke. Fannie Mae was established 72 years ago, and it's broke. Medicare and Medicaid started 45 years ago, and they're broke. Freddie Mac was established 40 years ago and it's broke. What I'm worried about is, are we on the brink of repeating that cascade of events? And all of this has happened in less than 2 years. Fast. Now, go back to the year 1904, and a woman who has been accused by some of plagiarizing everything she wrote said this in the opening pages of Volume 9 of Testimonies for the Church. Great changes are soon to take place in our world, and the final movements will be rapid ones. Well, if she was a plagiarist, I know where she copied that from. Wall Street Journal, 2010. Now, there's one more thing that we as Americans are doing, and it does concern me. We are spending money like a drunken sailor. And I have seen drunken sailors spend money, believe me. After 6 weeks on patrol, they go ashore. They haven't had anything to spend money on the ship. And they're unloading cash as if it's toxic waste. And the phrase is usually, there's plenty more where that came from, baby. I have extracted some of my spending sailors from jail when their thirst began writing checks their bodies couldn't cash. We are doing the same thing in a national sense now. We are now spending money by the trillions. Do you have any idea how much $1 trillion is? Let me illustrate it for you. Here is a $100 bill. There it is. $100. I can remember the time when that was, represented real money. By the way, nearly every one of these things, this is the medium of exchange all over the world for two classes of people, drug runners and terrorists. They use the $100 bill. It's a very handy medium of exchange. So that every one of these you handle, if you were swabbed thereafter for exposure to controlled substances, you probably would test positive. Most $100 bills have residue of narcotics on them. Well, there's $100, okay? Would you like to see what $1,000 looks like? There it is. Just 10 of them. 10 brand new, hopefully narcotic-free $100 bills. That's $1,000. Now, from that, you can probably get the impression that it wouldn't be that hard to carry $1,000,000 around, and it wouldn't. You take $100 bills, you take four stacks of these, stack them just about a foot high, so you have four 1 foot high stacks of these, and you'd have $1,000,000. It only weighs something like 16 pounds. You could carry it in a backpack. And earlier in practice, we've had some people come in to the office, not realizing that they're going to have to be reported when they do it. I well remember one guy came in. He looked like somebody out of some old Hollywood movie with a suit five sizes too small, you know. He comes in with a briefcase, and we were doing some work for somebody down on the L.A. waterfront. He comes in, the boss told me to give you this. Hands us a briefcase, flips it open, it's full of $100 bills, okay. Now that we can't do. That's a reportable transaction. I have a client right now who, forgot to pay taxes on some of his income, kept meticulous records. He knows exactly what he reported and what he didn't report. And he went down and made the mistake of buying a $40,000 car for cash. Whereupon, under 6015I of the Internal Revenue Code, the car dealer had to report him. Now, guess what? Terrorists are now buying cars for cash. You suppose he set off bells ringing in government agencies? I am racing to get him back to the IRS for a voluntary disclosure before the IRS starts investigating, because once they do, he doesn't do anything voluntarily at all. It's, two silver bracelets with a short retainer chain. So anyway, $1,000,000 is not that hard to carry. 16 pounds, one backpack. You could put $2.4 million easily in this banker's box. Easy. It would fit in with a little bit of room to spare. $2.4 million. So there in that box is almost $2.5 million. Now, what would $1 billion look like? Well, it would look like 416 of these. You could rent a Ryder truck and carry $1 billion. Not that hard. 416 of these is $1 billion. Would you like to know what $1 trillion looks like? That's these covering a space a little bit larger than a football field. We're talking about a football field a foot deep in $100 bills, a little bit spreading over the margins of it. That is $1 trillion. That's the way we're spending money now. Well, no problem. That shouldn't be a problem, should it? If we need more of these, to pay the national debt, all we got to do is this. Okay? Just turn the printing press on. That should solve the problem, shouldn't it? But we'll get to that in just a moment. By the way, these things are real. I got them from the Department of Bureau of Engraving and Printing. Now let's get back to our ship going sideways. What we've been doing recently under more than one national administration, this isn't the blame of any single party. What we've been doing nationally is this. Okay? And the problem comes is that we have set in motion now a train of circumstances where the current of our spending is pushing us sideways so that for every foot we advance toward whatever goal we want, we get swept away from it and we get swept toward dangerous waters. It's a concept called set. By the way, that can also happen theologically. You take the Advent message and you start playing games with it, deciding what matters and what doesn't, and what's a pillar and what isn't, and after all, we all have access to truth. The Holy Spirit speaks to all of us. Maybe I see it differently from you. Maybe what the pioneers thought was important isn't important anymore. At least it's not important to me. And what you involve yourself in then is this process of set where you no longer have a fixed course to steer and you're heading for shoal water. And that's where a ship or a nation starts drifting, and everybody can see this isn't going to end well, and people start feeling fear and then panic, and they're starting to ask themselves, that water looks green out there, it doesn't look good, what's underneath it? Where are we going in the future? And this afternoon I offer some ideas. I think, I could be wrong, been wrong many times, but I think sooner than you realize you're going to be carrying a national identity card. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's do this in an orderly fashion, and I'll explain why I think that's where we're headed. I'm a tax attorney. Let's first talk about taxes. So let me put on the board here, kind of in an orderly fashion, what we're going to be covering. And the first is taxation. I predict that you will soon see major changes in a lot of our tax structure, starting probably with the marginal tax brackets. The United States has just spent more money than we had previously spent for all the wars we've ever fought in our whole history. We've just recently spent more money than we've ever spent on war. Do you have any idea how expensive war is? Have you noticed that on your long-distance telephone bills, a tax has disappeared within the last few months? There's a tax that used to be there. It ain't there anymore. You go looking for it, it's not there. It just disappeared. You know what that was? There was a tax imposed on long-distance telephone calls designed to pay for the Spanish-American War. We just got it paid for, so the tax disappeared. And the thing lasted, what, all of 3 weeks or something? I mean, war is very expensive. Now, we've just spent more money than we've spent on all the wars in American history. So how do we pay for our debt? How do we finance our deficit lifestyle? Well, the first thing we do is we go hat in hand to an increasingly skeptical world, to lenders, to national lenders like the Chinese, who, sensing our weakness, are already talking not so quietly about a currency other than the dollar for world trade. That is already the subject of opinion. It's already being talked about. And who simultaneously are dictating foreign policy to us on subjects as critical as a lethally dangerous potential enemy in the Mideast now going nuclear. There are real downsides to deficit spending. There are real downsides to borrowing, to being a net debtor nation. So the first thing we can do with respect to solving our spending problem is to borrow. But at the rate Uncle Sam is now spending money, there's no way to survive with just borrowing. I mean, the Chinese have spent nearly $1 trillion on us, the Mideast $3.5 trillion more. To need more money, we need more than loans. So item number two is raise taxes. And read my lips, no more taxes doesn't work. We've already seen how long that lasts after an election. I predict, number one, higher marginal income tax rates. Right now, if you're at the top bracket, you're looking at 35%. I expect it will go higher, and don't be surprised if you're in the top marginal rates, you will also get a surtax on top of that that will probably operate very much like the AMT does now, the alternative minimum tax. In other words, you'll go to the top bracket if you're a top wage earner. On top of that, you'll pay a penalty for having paid so much taxes. So expect that. That'll be for the Americans who do pay taxes. 47% of Americans do not, which means that the burden is going to become increasingly heavy on those who do. So I expect we probably will see higher taxes. At the worst, back in the 50s and 60s, taxes reached as high as 90% of income for top wage earners. When that happens, people lose incentive to really try to make money anymore, and the economy tends to depress. Number two, expect higher estate and gift tax rates. You're all aware, of course, that if a person really wants to do effective estate planning, this is the year to quit living. 2010, there is no estate tax. In 2011, it goes back all the way back to where you've only got $1 million exemption for your estate. And a lot of people in Seattle and L.A., their home alone is a big chunk of $1 million. So you don't have that much of an exemption for an estate. And after that, you can go up and pay up to 55% of your estate goes out in taxes. Expect to see a higher estate and gift tax rate. Even that will not cover the cost of a nation spending money at the rate of $100 bills piled a foot high over a football field. So I expect a strong push for a value-added tax. That one's going to bite. That one's going to hit everybody, even the 47% who do not pay taxes. That one will imperceptibly affect you by raising the cost of goods and services. When I took my LLM, which was a postgraduate degree in tax law, one of the topics we first had to study was the consumption tax model. That is to say, change the whole system around so you're not taxed on your income, you're taxed when you spend things. This is the direction the government is now thinking of going, probably will have to go, unless we want to go broke as a nation. And the problem is it won't replace the income tax, it will supplement the income tax. A larger and larger proportion of your income will go for tax. We may hear cries for a fair tax. Something simple. To me, that's an oxymoron. I'm not sure any tax is all that fair. They'll say, this will simplify things. I hope they do, because if they introduce a new simple fair tax, it will create more work for us tax attorneys than we've had for years. You know why? As soon as that kind of tax gets passed, there will be special interest groups coming to Congress saying, well, that may be good for the rest of them, but we deserve an exception because we're a vital industry, we provide a vital service, and pretty soon you have all of the loopholes and problems of the current tax codes that we have now. Now, my purpose for this brief tax lecture is simply to say that all of this that I see coming will lead us to a predictable societal change. And here's what I expect will happen. When taxes go up, what happens to people's behavior? Their behavior modifies to accommodate and avoid taxation. In other words, economic activities go off the books as far as possible so they don't have tax consequences. People tend to hide anything they do that has a tax consequence. What's the result? You see more and more things like barter, like an underground economy, services in exchange for goods, services in exchange for services. I'm a lawyer. I'll give you free services if you, in turn, will give me the root canal I need. That type of thing, you see. Services for anything to keep it off Schedule C or Schedule K or Form 1040. What you see is a change in human behavior. Years ago when I was attending a tax conference, one of the presenters there said, we've done studies and about the most you can expect people to tolerate in America is a 40% effective tax rate. Beyond that, it's like trying to pile sand. You can pile sand higher and all it does is spread wider, but 40% is about all the public will tolerate. In other words, if you get beyond a level where most people are willing to accommodate and pay up, what you do is you begin to see the first signs of a societal breakdown. People begin to cheat the system. It's kind of like incipient anarchy. People retreat into their own lives, into their own welfare. The sense of country and common good goes away, and it's replaced by the early stages of the survival mentality. Me and my family shut the front gate, don't let anybody in, and when it reaches its ultimate conclusion, it shut the front gate and shoot the first thing that comes in sight. We'll get to that when I discuss item 4, which is societal breakdown. But in the meantime, taxation, the first item on our list here, to my way of thinking, threatens a classic economic model. You go off the books, you begin to do things that don't create taxes, and in the process of doing that, what problems do you create for the government? Suddenly the government can't predict how much tax revenue it's going to have. And it's obviously very important that they do that, because you remember the debate during the health care proposal in Congress, where the Congressional Budget Office was repeatedly consulted and asked, will there be enough money to pay for this? What will be the effect on taxes? And the Congressional Budget Office issued opinions based on the kind of taxes we can generate in this country and our ability to afford a national health care system. Now, their ability to do that depends entirely on the assumption people will, in fact, honestly pay what's assessed. When you have an underground economy, when you have people not reporting income, suddenly the government can no longer project how much money they're going to make. You can no longer control people or control their economic behavior. Change number 1, I predict in this country, will be majorly seen in taxation. Get ready. Remember where you heard it first. And that leads us to point number 2. Right behind taxation, or maybe in concert with it, is a major problem called inflation. Let's talk about inflation just a little bit, and then we're going to see where all of this leads in the prism of Revelation's predictions for end time events, because this stuff is just going down the track like it's on rails. It just amazes me. There are 2 reasons I see the monster of inflation coming. The first one is we're going in debt like a drunken sailor. We're spending money we don't have. We keep talking about our grandkids are going to have to pay this. Forget it. They won't have enough money to pay for it. When you're in catastrophically in debt, like we're getting, and you're also able to do this, to create money, what would you be very tempted to do? Work the system so the money you're paying back is worth less than the money you borrowed. You following me? Intentionally induced inflation. If I borrowed $1,000 from you, you know, one of these things. If I borrowed that from you and I had to pay you back in a year, and I could control the value of money, you suppose I might be tempted to manipulate the system so the money I paid you back was only worth $750. I'd have made $250 on the transaction. So one thing governments do when they get catastrophically in debt is they play games with their currency and they debase their currency so they're theoretically paying back the debt but with money that isn't worth very much. Let me give you an example of how things go along that line. I'm going to hold up for you here a piece of paper money that was once issued by the United States. Now it's kind of big. We don't carry pieces of money, pieces of paper money, currency this big anymore. You know why? And notice something else. It's in gold ink. You know what it's good for? This certifies that there have been deposited in the Treasury of the United States of America $10 in gold coin, payable to the bearer on demand. You carried this thing back in those days. This represented something with intrinsic value in it. You could go and get the gold, and you knew the gold wasn't going to deflate in value. Well, a little bit of time went on, and the government took gold out of circulation. By the way, they bought it from people, made it a crime to hold gold, bought it from people for $15 an ounce, and a few weeks later turned around and sold it for $30. Well, after gold went out of circulation, silver was still in circulation. Here I'm holding a silver certificate. This one says, there is on deposit in the Treasury of the United States $5 in silver payable to the bearer on demand. You could still demand something with intrinsic value in it. This also became unfashionable, and finally out came something called a Federal Reserve note, also worth $5. But this isn't payable in anything with intrinsic value. This one depends on what? You just gotta believe it's worth something. This piece of paper absolutely depends on trust. If trust breaks down, you can paper the walls with this stuff. Now, thank God that hasn't happened yet. I don't wish that on my country. I live well. I love this country. I fought under its flag. I don't wish it ill. But all I'm saying is I see plenty of signs for concern that we're leaving an era in which our medium of exchange had some kind of built-in value to the point where it doesn't. Sometimes governments intentionally inflate their currency. That's some of the international give and take we face now. But there's an even scarier genesis for inflation. It's scarier because it's out of anybody's control. It just happens to you. It just happens. Congress has just voted a football field filled with $100 bills a foot deep. How do we hope to pay for it? Credit, of course. That's where we've always gotten it. Which means we're doing what? Paying the house payments with the Visa card. I've had clients that did that. And I've had to get them out of deep trouble with the IRS as a result. But who issues our Visa card? Well, for one, China, the People's Republic of China, now openly talking of a new world currency other than the dollar. Now stop and think, China is already nearly $1 trillion into U.S. debt. They're publicly nervous about our ability to repay. They're starting to tell us in pretty clear terms, get your act together. And they're watching us go toward an impossible debt to GNP ratio. Within the foreseeable future, 90% of our whole gross domestic product will be used to service the interest on our debt. When you hit 100%, you're definitionally bankrupt. Can you sense the first winds of a storm? So the question is, will our national credit card always work, or will there be that awful day somewhere in the future where we put it in the machine, pull it back, and across the face of the machine comes back the ugly message, declined. What if our foreign creditors decide our credit is not worth the risk? Overnight, what happens to this? This is wallpaper. And what happens when a country's currency debases? Well, the classic example of that is Germany after World War I. The victorious Western powers imposed huge reparations on Germany. They couldn't pay it. They finally decided, okay, we'll pay it. All we'll do is start printing Reichsmarks. We'll just print the money. We will do this. And say to the Western powers, there you are. There's your money. You asked for it. Here it is. It finally got so worthless, it wasn't worth ink for both sides. Now, you see, we're still printing money on both sides. You see that? Well, for the German mark, it was finally so worthless, it wasn't worth ink for both sides of the paper. So they started printing on only one side. And in 1921, and $1 could buy 263 marks. By August of 1923, $1 could buy 4.62 million marks. By December of 1924, $1 could buy 4.2 trillion marks. That's your football field full of money. And a story went illustrated of how two Germans in those bad days were walking down the street. One German, Heinrich, had his wheelbarrow just piled high with marks. That would buy one loaf of bread. And Gerhard, who was walking with him, said, Heinrich, what are you going to do with this when we go in to get the bread? Oh, he says, I'm going to leave it on the street. Nobody will steal that stuff. It's worthless. He was right. When he came back out, his money was in a heap. Somebody had stolen the wheelbarrow. That is hyperinflation. Now, could that be in our future? Well, at this stage of the game, we would be very wise to move from just secular information to an inspired source. So I commend you to Revelation 18. Now, Revelation 18, beginning with verse 1, sets the stage for a world headed for major problems, including what appear to be economic problems. And the first verse says, after these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory, and he cried mightily, Babylon is fallen, has become a dwelling place of demons. Okay, now, that's the setting of the stage. Now, what we're about to read is one of the few passages where the Bible even hints at an economic forecast. Now, there's lots in the Bible about wealth, but almost always on how we handle it responsibly as believers, there's almost nothing on the economy as an academic topic, and I think it's pretty obvious why. You know, the Bible wasn't intended to be used as a spiritual Dun and Bradstreet. Its purpose is to make us spiritually sound. It's not to give us financial advice. But once in a while, something sneaks in, and Revelation 18 is one of those exceptions. Now, you move on down to the 11th verse, and you get a very clear picture of something economically going very, very wrong. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones, every kind of objects. Verse 14, and all the things that are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more at all. This is terminal. It doesn't say this is a downturn followed by a cycle. It just says this is it. This is a terminal global problem. You don't find them anymore. Verse 15, the merchants who became rich by her will stand at a distance weeping and wailing, saying, alas, alas, for in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing. And now I think it's good to move down here and let's talk about what the Bible's really saying here. The Bible says in 1 hour it all disappears. And the Greek word there is horah. What that means, what the Greek word means, is basically a very short period of time, not necessarily a literal hour. We translate that hour in the Bible. What it means in Greek is very short, very brief, indeterminate period of time. Thank God, that's the word they use, because that same word also is used in Revelation describing a time of trouble such as never was. We can sometimes, I think, maybe hyperventilate too much about the time of trouble and fixate on it, when I think that the period of time for that is very, very short. Now, I think the function of the time of trouble is very simple. We as human beings just tend to hang on to this world even though we claim to have faith, don't we? Very much like the cat that you're trying to get out of a tree. He wants out badly. You climb the ladder, you grab a hold of him, and he grabs a hold of that tree with all his claws because he doesn't want to leave the tree. That's us. And I think the time of trouble is heaven's way of pulling our claws out of a world that has nothing left for us anymore. So anyway, here in Revelation 18, it talks about that very brief period of time. In other words, just like that, such great riches are come to nothing. It all happens fast. Now, go back to verse 17 here. See the global implications of this. World trade has gone awry here. Every shipmaster and as many as trade on the sea cried out, weeping and wailing, alas, alas for that great city, for all who had ships on the sea became rich by her, for in 1 hour, hurrah, 1 hour she is made desolate. Global economic collapse, and it happens fast. Now, turn, if you will, to the book of James. Turn over to James chapter 5, verse 1. And James seems also to be talking about a time when wealth, as we have come to expect it and know it in this world, disappears. James 5, verse 1, come now, you rich, weep and howl, for your misery is coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver are corroded. Or some translations say rusted. Okay. Now, for those of you who didn't sleep through middle school chemistry, what's wrong with that sentence? Gold and silver have what? Rusted. Well, what's wrong in that sentence is that gold don't rust. Huh? This stuff here is so chemically inert. You've got to mix very concentrated nitric and sulfuric acid as a combination called aqua regia to get it to react with gold. Gold is almost chemically inert. It's so inert that in our early satellites, when we first launched out into space, we coated them with gold in case there was something out there that would corrode a satellite. We figured, well, gold's pretty much impervious to anything. So we sent gold-plated satellites into space. That's some of our national debt, folks. It's sailing around up there. Okay. Now, James said this stuff corrodes. Silver doesn't rust. You housewives know you got to clean it off once in a while, but it doesn't rust. Something happens to this kind of metal. In James's metaphor, where it does the chemically impossible, it rusts. What he's describing is impossible unless the rules of chemistry were to change, or to carry the metaphor where I think he intended it to go, unless the rules of economics changed, and I think we're beginning to see that happen. The rules of economics we relied on simply do not prove to be much more reliable. Now, Jesus also, fascinatingly, used the metaphor of rust. Turn, if you will, to Matthew 6. Matthew 6, verse 19, here's Jesus speaking. As I said before, you know, if you've got doubts about anybody, at least he ought to be a reasonably good authority. Jesus says, lay not up for yourselves treasures on the earth where moth and what? Rust doth corrupt, where thieves break through and steal. Once again, Jesus is talking about wealth disappearing as if it's rust going through your fingers, and then he talks about thievery. And I ask you this afternoon, does a thief always have to be a bad guy with a black mask over his eyes? Or could a thief be a policy that borrows from the future money it knows can never be repaid? And that drives a nation into bankruptcy.